Her spider eyes looked out, and the worship hall of the narrow and low-lying nunnery had turned into a huge and ancient structure. A myriad of ox-headed, horse-faced monsters stretched out from cracks in the vermilion walls, the columns of the structure shuddering precariously, their stone footings groaning as if they couldn't bear the load. Suddenly, with a thundering sound like the sundering of heaven and earth, the ancient structure completely collapsed. Yellow dust shot high into the air, smashed bricks, shattered tiles, splintered beams, cracked rafters, along with clouds of dirt infused with reds and greens. They all scattered and bounced wildly in all directions before settling onto the broad earth with a noise like thunder, but sounding more like a mournful cry or gasp. Suddenly, a wisp of green smoke issued from the collapsed ruins, becoming higher and broader as it came forth, enshrouding the ancient, decayed pile of ruins. Little moss-like objects competed to burst forth from the green smoke coming from the ruins. They took on all kinds of colors and all kinds of shapes. The little things swaying back and forth in the smoke slowly grew larger, and a face formed on each one. Now that's part of the closing scene of the recent translation of Mao Dun's Waverings by David Hall. This came out recently with the Research Center for Translation at the Chinese University of Hong Kong as a renditions paperback, and it came out in 2014. Now, Dave and I just talked about this translation, and it is really, at the same time, a beautiful work of English prose and one that's just a really moving experience and a pleasure to read. And it's also a wonderful moment and monument that kind of situates us in a larger context of 1920s revolutionary China, and then informs, I think, how we understand not just the history of modern China, but also experiences thereof and efforts to render those experiences and re-render, as you'll hear, those experiences in fictional form. So it's a rather extensive conversation, and I'll let you get right to it, but I'll just say this was a book that really was a page-turner for me, and that I'm really excited not just to reread for the pleasure of the prose, but also to teach in contexts on modern East Asia and or 20th century China. It really was a pleasure to read through, and it was a pleasure as well to talk with Dave about it. So I hope you have a chance to get your hands on a copy of the book. It's well worth reading, and it's absolutely well worth assigning if you are in the position of teaching a class of undergraduates or graduate students in modern China. So thanks for listening. Thanks very much, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here to talk with David Hall about his new translation of Mao Dun's Waverings. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Dave. Thanks so much for writing this book, for translating, for being with me today, and for being willing to talk about not just this particular book, but also one of the most important crafts in our profession, that is the craft of the translator. So welcome, and thank you again.
Thank you very much, Carla.
So let's start at the beginning. What brought you to work on China and on Chinese literature in particular?
Well, it is a kind of a long and very checkered past. I originally went to school for a theater degree and with a kind of a minor in history, and ran out of money very quickly and had to kind of run off to the army and the embrace of the GI Bill before coming back to school. And then when I came back, it was originally looking at a history or perhaps a political science degree, but very quickly this was at UC Santa Barbara, and I ran into Ron Egan, who is one of the most wonderful, genuine, beautiful kind of Chinese-style scholars that you'll ever meet. And I fell in love with all of the literature that he kind of presented, and kind of tying in with my earlier historical background and political science background, the pre-revolutionary period was kind of a natural kind of a wonderful fit. And I think what really drew me to it is we have all of these incredible canonical authors, the Lu Xuns and Shen Tongwen and Ding Ling and all of these people that we always read and should read, of course. But it's amazing the sheer volume that was being put out in those years. It's easy to forget how much really wonderful and sometimes overlooked stuff is still there and still kind of woefully A, untranslated, and B, understudied. There's a lot of dross and there's a lot of horrible stuff there too, but the good stuff is still being mined in that kind of pre-revolutionary period.
And I love your story of how you came to the field also, in part because it's amazing to me constantly how many of us were brought into the field of China, Chinese history, Chinese literature, thanks to the inspiration of a really special human.
Yes.
A special human of one sort of another. So thank you to all of you special humans out there who have inspired some of us to come and do the work that we do.
Which makes me feel slightly better because I missed his panel at AAS.
AAS. That's the Association for Asian Studies annual meeting for all listeners. That was just in Chicago. And yes, I missed all of the panels. So I think we can just agree to forgive each other and it's okay. So Dave, what's the focus of your research when you're not translating Mao Dun's works? What do you work on within the broader field of Chinese literature?
I think probably if I had to narrow it down, the main thing that is constantly interesting to me is the narrative voice and narrative mode as it shifts through this kind of move into modernity or move into realism, and kind of trying to tease out the intentional and perhaps not so intentional ways in which different authors try to bring their stories to us, and obviously in my particular period, it's kind of the very pained rise of realism and how so many authors looked toward realism and naturalism as a way of escaping, you know, this bugaboo of tradition and moving into modernity and moving into what some people would call a new Western version of fiction that might again, to fall back on the tropes, that might save the nation.
So the book that we're talking about today is a translation of the second novel in a trilogy. This is the Eclipse Trilogy, comprising three books: Disillusions, Waverings, which is the one we're talking about today, and Pursuits. Now, they were first published serially in something that can be translated as the Short Story Magazine, beginning in 1927, and they're the first fiction written by the man Shen Yanbing, who would later take on the pseudonym Mao Dun. And many of us who work on China or Chinese history have either read or have taught with and about Mao Dun. So how did you come to this particular writer and to this particular project? And why was it important for you to translate this work in particular?
Well, it was... I first really ran into him. I had read a couple of his earlier translated works, Rainbow and Midnight, but it was in a graduate seminar with another one of those great human beings, Ted Hueters, where we read Waverings. And during the discussion, Ted had mentioned that one of the kind of interesting hidden secrets of this novel was that it was massively re-edited after 1949, after the establishment of the People's Republic, and that the differences were fairly profound. And this really stuck in my mind. I had originally been working on some earlier translation studies, research projects, and almost immediately shifted my entire dissertation plan to start looking at this problem of these two texts of Waverings. And the text itself it has its own problems, but it's a wonderful collection of many of the things that brought me to literature, to Chinese literature. The problematic characters, the internal tensions, and the political strife, and some genuinely beautiful writing as well, which is a nice bonus.
Awesome. Now, you mentioned political strife, and that's actually really, really important, I think, for us to understand in terms of understanding the context of the novel and the way that some of the events of the novel unfold. Mm-hmm. So Waverings offers readers a perspective on events that were taking place in 1926 and 1927, so revolutionary events in particular. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit about what was happening in this period, and perhaps specifically what was happening in terms of its impact on Mao Dun at the time? That's important for us to understand in order for us to understand what you take to be important aspects of the context of the novel.
Yeah, sure. I think we can take a quick step back and do a little bit of biography for Mao Dun before he was a political actor and before he was a novelist. He was a literary critic, and he was incredibly focused in bringing translated texts from the West to China, and again with this goal that somehow this would be able to strengthen the intellectual body of China, so that China could survive this onslaught of forces. And for Mao Dun, he saw this as kind of there was a hierarchy of narrative modes, this idea that all literature moves from classicism to romanticism to realism or naturalism, and then maybe into symbolism or neo-romanticism after that. And so he saw himself not as a writer at all. He saw himself as someone who was guiding China through this path of evolution. And the standard reading was, of course, that the West had moved on to neo-romanticism while China was still caught in romanticism. And so by bringing these texts, these translated texts, he could kind of help Chinese authors learn how to write these advanced narrative modes and help the Chinese audience kind of learn how to read them. And so that's where he was when he started, you know, reading like everyone else was reading Chen Duxiu and the kind of the New Youth magazines, and was kind of turned on to his political path. And he immediately aligned himself with the leftists and the communists. In fact, he is probably one of the earliest members of the Communist Party. He kind of joined their reading groups in 1921, I think it was. But in any case, by the time we get to the mid and late 20s, the Communist Party has been subsumed within the Nationalist Party, which is Chiang Kai-shek's kind of national size party that is kind of meant to bring the entirety of China under one rule again. But by the time we get to 1926, 1927, the split between the leftists and the rightists within the Nationalist Party becomes violent, and there's actually an insurrection and a crackdown where Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists, very often this is referred to as the Shanghai Massacre and other risings, where Chiang Kai-shek basically brings out all of the communists and in ideological terms purges them, but in real terms there are literal battlefields and literal battles that are fought, sometimes in the cities and sometimes in the countryside. Where Mao Dun fits in this is he flees one of the centers of these battles. He flees Wuhan and tries to make it back to Shanghai while all these battles are happening, and he becomes ill, ends up staying in this mountain town while all these battles are playing out. And by the time he eventually gets to Shanghai, the battles are over, the communists are obliterated, they're all running to the hills, and many of the people he knew are now dead. And so he's trapped in Shanghai, in hiding, trying to avoid the secret police of the Nationalists, and he has nothing to do. And in one of his articles, he writes, he wanted to try to give a ray of hope to his compatriots that had survived, and the only thing he could think of to do was to write this novel as a way of giving them something to hang on to, something to move forward with. Now, that's not what the novels end up doing, and that, you know, but that was kind of his motivation for writing, or at least the motivation he tells us.
Right. So it's a really powerful story, actually. It's just even just the story itself of how this novel gets written and then, as we'll come to in a moment, gets rewritten, right? Itself really, really interesting. Now, am I correct in understanding that this was actually written also very quickly, right?
Yes, especially the first two novels, Huan Mie, The Disillusions and Waverings, were written in the course of a handful of months at most. Pursuits, which is, to be honest, even more interesting than Waverings. It's a much bigger mess, but it's much more interesting. Took I think nearly a year to finish off, and is problematic for a number of reasons.
Thank you. So this is written quickly in, I think it's said in the translation, the fall of 1927, as you said, while he's in hiding in Shanghai. And as you've already mentioned, there were two different versions of the text. So one was written in 1927 and published in 1928 over three issues of the magazine we mentioned before. And then there's a revision in 1954. So this is totally fascinating. And you've already mentioned the fact that this is a particularly interesting problem for you as well, right? And this is perhaps one of the ways you got interested in this work. So I want to just hit the ball back to you and ask you to talk about that. How did you come to the decision to translate the version or translate in light of this split yourself? And what are some of the most interesting differences between these versions? So differences between the 1928 and 1954 versions and how you dealt with that. Discuss.
Well, it's a wonderful problem to have. I'll say that from the very beginning. The 1954 version is, I should say that in 1949, of course, Mao Dun becomes the Minister of Culture for the People's Republic of China, and he is one of many authors who were savvy enough to stop writing fiction immediately once the People's Republic was established. It's very difficult to avoid a kind of a bad future if you're writing fiction in the PRC during those years. But in I think it was in 1953, or it might have actually been in 1954, they were planning to publish the complete works of Mao Dun, and one of the editors of the People's Press came to Mao Dun and said, "Do you want us to publish absolutely as is, or do you want to make certain changes?" And the implication was, you might want to go back and take a look at your novel. There might be some dangerous things there. And I think the quote was something like, there are some certain portions that you might want to look at again. And of course, Mao Dun, being a very politically savvy guy, immediately knows what's at stake here, and he struggles over this. He writes a wonderful article, kind of struggling about whether he should re-edit or rewrite the novels for the new political climate. And his main struggle is, if he doesn't edit it, then he might be guilty of passing down errors, which is an incredibly politically tinged, very dangerous accusation. If there are errors, if there are political problems in the original text and you just republish it, then you are certainly in danger of persecution. And on the other hand, he writes very, very movingly about the idea that if he changes anything from the original text, he might lose the essence of what was originally there. And this really strikes home for me, because in his later fiction, he writes very well, and he writes many good good novels, but much of the passion and much of the confusion and much of the tension from those very early works of fiction are gone as he becomes more politically stable. So when we get to the Eclipse trilogy and Waverings in particular, that tension and that very earnest confusion about the waverings of his characters, it's completely on his sleeve, whereas later on it becomes more categorizable in easily, you know, in the ideological forms. And so in the end, he kind of takes the practical course, and we say edits the book, but in some cases he completely rewrites major sections. An article I wrote a while ago kind of goes over the different categories of the changes that he made. The main one is, you know, he does just clean up some editorial stuff, of course. But in some cases, he will make political decisions. There's in one of the novels, one of there's a doctor in the novel who very, very dangerously says that China will, of course, after the war, have to take back Korea, Vietnam, and Siam, and all, you know, all of these things, right? And so clearly, that's going to get edited out. But some of the other categories are much more subtle. For me personally, I'm very interested in the narrative voice changes in the original text. There's a lot of narrator speak, which kind of harkens back to earlier traditions of the novel, where the narrator will speak to the reader. The classic standard is, if you want to know what happens next, you have to read the next chapter, right? Mm-hmm. There is some of that narrator speak in the 2728 text, and almost without exception, he removes it in the 54 text, and I believe that's generally to bring it in line with this ideal of what a realist novel should be. A realist novel should not have a narrator that speaks to the audience. But then there are some other things that there's a lot of sexuality that gets eliminated. There are some characters, many characters who are complicated and contradictory and problematic, and some of these characters are simplified and made into more ideologically convenient types. There's a famous in Waverings. There's a character, the widow Qian Suzhen, who you might remember from the novel. She is almost entirely eliminated in the 1954 edition of the novel, to the point where I think it's chapter 6. In the new version, in the 54 version, I think it runs a total of maybe 4 or 5 pages, because her entire story is eliminated. And my reading of that is that she's an incredibly interesting character, but she is problematic because she used to have bound feet. She's a widow. She's one of these types that could be a great kind of socialist martyr, but in fact she ends up kind of working with the reactionaries, and that doesn't work very ideologically cleanly in the 1954 political climate. And some literary critics had critiqued that character in particular. Qian Xingchun is one of the critics who said this character is a problem. And so it kind of shows that Maldun was listening, but, you know, maybe this was a character he was able to eliminate so that he could save some of the complications in the later characters. So to end this long blathering spiel, the reason I chose mainly to translate from the 2728 edition is that I think today, when students, particularly Chinese students, when they hear Mao Dun. They hear what he's famous for. They hear he's this famous realist author who writes about the contradictions and the problems within the hearts of the petty bourgeois who are trying to be revolutionaries. When they go back and they look at his novels, they look at, you know, Midnight and Rainbow, and those are well enough. But if they look to Waverings, they'll see the 1954 version, and it's not bad, but it's a diminished novel, and much of the things that he's famous for, these complicated female characters, these problematic, these issues, the kind of violent, raw feeling of the novels, it's kind of tamped down in the edition that they read. So I wanted to make sure that the English edition kind of was able to, in some way, hopefully show the English readers some of this torment that the original had, that kind of gained Mao Dun his fame, very rightfully so.
Awesome. And you've actually touched on already a bunch of really interesting issues that I'd love to ask you about. So I'm going to get to as many of them as I can. Now, one of them comes up in your discussions of the really interesting women characters, sexuality. Now, one of the most striking aspects of the novel, at least for me in my experience reading Waverings, to prepare for our conversation today, is in fact the way it takes on gender issues and issues of sexuality. So for you, I mean, this is all over the novel, right? There's a million one ways we can probably talk about this. But what are some of the most interesting ways for you that happens in Waverings?
Well, I think Mao Dun, he actually, in another one of his articles, he says that he draws many of his characters. His wife was involved in the women's movement at the time, and she would have many meetings in their home, and he would kind of be a fly on the wall and listen to these characters. So I think because he's one of these novelists who he's kind of one of the first people who is writing complicated, three-dimensional, fully formed female characters, he's drawing them from real people. You know, he claims that, of course, he's not pulling them wholesale from real people. But when we come up against characters like Sun Yang, who I think is one of the most interesting characters in the novel, mm-hmm. In many cases, she acts in a way that is ideologically unsupportable, and yet we recognize the actions. There's one incredible scene where she's trying to convince the kind of the lead character to go back to his wife and not pursue this potential adulterous relationship. And she ends this very impassioned conversation by kissing him. Mm-hmm. And it's a horribly painful situation because our main character is totally smitten with her, and she knows this, and yet she kisses him to try to give him a taste of this kind of wild world that he can't have. And in an ideologically correct world in which Mao Dun, the later Mao Dun, the minister of culture Mao Dun, lives, this is ideologically wrong and vile, and this proves that she is, you know, she's a corrosive character. But in that scene, it reads incredibly naturally, and it reads like something, you know, your best friend would tell you she did, and you're like, oh God, why did you do that? But you completely can see it. You can totally see this very sexual creature not understanding the torment that she would cause by kissing him. And so I think the kind of central character in those terms is Sun Yang. But of course, Mrs. Fang, the main character's wife, is also a wonderful but much more subtle exploration of how the feminine is still constrained within these petty bourgeois, these women who are attempting to try to explore ways of being their own agents, and yet are unable to come to terms with this, with the new, with the modern, and this sort of thing. And of course, that comes to a head in the climax of the novel. And then the other example that I generally give is the one I mentioned before, the widow Tien. She is a very constrained character that eventually she also uses her sexuality to kind of protect herself in a way that is totally understandable, but at the same time incompatible with the way that these idealists, in terms of their ideology, these idealists would see her and say, well, no, you have to either be, you know, a model hero or a martyr. You can't negotiate with the reactionaries, and doubly so, you can't negotiate with your sexuality. You can't negotiate with your body. And so those are three possibilities if you want to take any of those further.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually love to take all of them further, and perhaps we'll do so in different ways. But you mentioned the climax of the novel, right? And this is speaking of the way that the book deals with issues of gender and women in particular, this is a really, really powerful moment. So at this point in the novel, there is a discussion about the communization of women.
Yes. Right?
So maybe could you, for listeners who have never read about or read the novel and who might be interested in what's going on there, can you maybe take us into that part of what's going on? What's up with the communization of women, and how does this kind of explode by the end of the novel in really kind of an interesting but also really violent, you know, way?
Yeah, that's one of the things, as kind of a slight digression, that's one of the things that is quite shocking about this novel. I don't know whether you felt this as well, but the violence it comes on so fast and it's unexpected in a way that, again, kind of hits with the realism or the naturalism of the novel, and that's exactly. I mean, that's intentional in a way to show how while these characters are wavering back and forth and trying to find out who they are, other people are planning horrible, horrible things. But to go back to the communization of women, it's a funny thing. Well, funny is probably not the right word. It's a common thing that happens in most processes of socialization in nations where in our situation in the Chinese context, the socialists and the communists were saying, well, we need to try to free women. And mainly what they were thinking of were the concubines. They needed to be freed from their patriarchal family systems, and they needed to be given their own life. They're also very interested in Buddhist nuns. They want to be able to, because in many cases, women, girls would become nuns because they had no other options, and they wanted to kind of free women from those kind of feudal and patriarchal systems. And what would happen is that they would propagandize those kind of, we're going to free women, we're going to take them out of these situations. But what almost always happens is in these terms, the reactionaries, the non-communists would say, well, if you are communists, and communism literally means kind of the sharing of property, mm-hmm. then when you talk about freeing these women, you're talking about moving, because women are property, you're talking about moving these women into a social sphere rather than in a private sphere. And logically, that means if you're moving them from private, you're moving these products, these pieces of property from the private realm to a free realm. That means that they're going to be in a social sphere. And because women are property and you are communizing property, communizing women is a logical step. And it sounds absurd when you lay it out like that, but it makes for incredibly effective propaganda when you say that, well, the communists are coming and they're going to take all of your women and they're going to share your women with the peasantry.
Right. And in this, just to kind of jump in, and at this moment, as you mentioned just before, the really shocking onset and onslaught of the violence. There's this move where, as a reader, you're reading through and you're reading, you know, these sort of these propagandistic claims in the novel that, you know, women are property, so we should have wives to the wifeless and distribute. Right. And it's like, ha ha, oh, that's kind of funny. You know, this is right. Satire, ha ha. And you're laughing. And then suddenly you've got women dead in the gutter with their mm-hmm. breasts cut off. And it's this incredibly violent, like, smack in the face, like, whoa, stop laughing. You know, like something massive just happened. What happened?
And I'll throw in one kind of complication to this in that specific scene when they bring women out basically to a marketplace, and they're drawing lots to see which of these horribly scabby headed peasants are going to be given the beautiful concubine of one of the local leaders. Clearly the satire is there, and it's, you know, we're laughing at this very gorgeous kind of spoiled woman that's being handed to this rude peasant. And the closing of that scene is like a kind of a dash of ice water, because when things start to fall apart, the peasant grabs the woman and rushes her into a local temple, presumably to rape her. And then there's this horrifying line. You hear the laughter of the woman coming out of the out from the walls of the temple, and it's never explained. But you can imagine this the world of this woman. And she, the whole time she's been resisting and trying to get away, but then we get her laughter. And so it's sometimes Mao Tun is very heavy-handed with the things that he wants you to see, but the way that is left hanging is haunting in a very disconcerting way.
Yeah. I mean, it stays with you. And even that rapidity of the move from, ha-ha, right. That's satire, that's so funny, wait a minute. Yeah. How did she, like, what's going on? But you mentioned just before, or just now, the word haunting. And that brings up another really, I think, interesting element of the book that I'd really love to ask you about. So you mentioned Mrs. Feng a little bit earlier. She's the wife of one of the main characters, and she's really, really interesting and a very complex kind of character, yes. As you've mentioned already. Now, there's the scene at the end of the novel where she sees a spider. Mm-hmm. But what it means to see this spider is really, really complicated and really beautiful and really kind of astounding. And it's mm-hmm. one of many moments in the novel where visions and illusions become really important and actually really beautifully rendered and really touching and moving parts of the narrative. So can you take us into this element of the novel by maybe talking a little bit about Mrs. Feng's spider? Mm-hmm. And maybe we can talk more broadly about your approach to an understanding of the recurrence of illusions mm-hmm. and visions here.
So the final scene that you're talking about is very difficult to get through. I teach this novel as often as I can, and it's always fun to see how students, how undergraduates deal with this passage. It is she is basically at the end of her rope. She is exhausted mentally and physically, and they're fleeing the city, which has fallen to basically an invading army. And in this one moment where she feels that she's found a slight place of safety, she and her husband are together again, and they're in this place of safety, this nunnery, this old nunnery. She kind of collapses, and Sun Wuyang, the character that her husband may or may not have been at least emotionally cheating on her with, comes in and tells her Mrs. Feng that her best friend has been murdered in a horribly brutal and visceral way, and she snaps into this hallucination, and so she sees a spider that's been swinging it on a strand, one strand thread from the ceiling, and the spider is kind of floating back and forth, and it starts to become bigger, and it becomes kind of this bloated, distended body that's hanging from the thread, and it seems to be, you know, gasping for breath, and it suddenly transforms into this huge disgusting vision of flying heads and demonic creatures, and at some place she becomes this spider, and she is looking out from its spider eyes, and it's playing on the surface kind of level. It's playing with this idea of herself being unable to control where she is and being kind of blown back and forth in by the wind, but the extent that this fantasy, this illusion goes to is much larger than just Mrs. Fong herself. It's kind of a collapsing of the entire type of woman, the entire type of person that she is kind of not necessarily symbolic of, but that she inhabits. Mm-hmm. And to move on to kind of the illusions in general, there are three or four kind of major illusions in the hallucinations in the book, and at each point they come from a character kind of being struck by a blow. The first one we see is our main character Fang Luolan. He goes out to the backyard, and he's kind of frustrated with his home life, and he sees this vision, kind of these fireflies come together and form a vision of the face of Sun Weiyang and this kind of woman that he's attracted to, and it's a very poignant thing because this gorgeous, beautiful woman appears before him, and what snaps him out of the hallucination is hearing his wife and his son playing in the kitchen. And so there's this interplay between realism, which is what Mao Dun is critically interested in. Realism is, again, the way that China is going to be saved. It's an incredibly serious undertaking. But he continually is playing with it where reality breaks and realism is unable to carry forth the narrative. And so when Fang Luolan becomes obsessed with this woman, reality breaks. It's unable to hold together, and therefore we have this illusion, this fantasy. And in the same way, in the end of the novel, it's critical that the novel ends without realism. You know, realism is the way we save China, but yet at the end of this novel, we can't bring closure to any of this without this fantastic hallucination and illusion. And I think it's speaking directly to this idea of the ability for realism to handle the very real problems that Mao Dun sees in society. And as much as he says he believes that realism is the way forward and realism is the way to help, he is acutely aware that the very real people that are living in these situations might not be able to hold together with reality, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it totally does. And it really, I mean, I should say this I should have said this right away, but I'm going to say it now. Congratulations on the translation, because in the English, you know, I'm reading through, this must have been really challenging, right, to render and to render so seamlessly this movement from a very realistic tone to suddenly we're in this hallucination that's gorgeous. I mean, the prose of it is just gorgeously rendered. So thank you for that. And also, I'm astounded by the skill that it must have taken to do that and to make it work so well, because it really is a pulling of us really smoothly and seamlessly from this hyper-realistic or a very realistic mode of narration to suddenly, you know, we're a many-headed spider, or suddenly we're in this, you know, vision of this femme fatale as the, you know, it's just really gorgeously done.
Well, and I mean, I thank you. I think most of the credit obviously goes to Mao Dun, but one of the things that he kind of helped me with that translation is that he's not always a beautiful writer, and there's certainly some problems with his prose. But one of the things in that specific passage that he does very well is he doesn't tip his hand at all. In terms of especially moving in and out of illusion, he is able, and I think this speaks broader to the way he deals with characters in general. He has a sympathy or perhaps an empathy with the characters to the point where he's able to the technical term, of course, is the free indirect voice, the idea that the narration is moving through the point of view of the character who is the principal of the scene. And he does this with such skill that through most of the novel, we're kind of reading the world through Fang Luolan, the main character, his point of view. But in this case, we've moved into seeing the world from Mrs. Fang's point of view. And because that move is so seamless, I think the move from her reality into her illusion is something that we are more acclimated to. We see that movement is not shocking when we move from character to character. And so we're tricked in a way by when we move into this spider world because of that free indirect speech, or the way that the narrative is shifted like that.
And in fact, it's almost more shocking, not almost more, I think at least as a reader, it's more shocking when we're still when we're moving from circumstances to then consequences in mm-hmm. this realistic mode of narration, right? Again, just the sudden shocking right. Outcomes that come when we're not expecting them than it is when we're moving to and from what might be described as reality and illusion.
Yeah, yeah. And I should mention, of course, you know, spoiler alert, of course, but the final line, I think, is quite well put together, because that's in her illusion world, you know, everything is collapsing, the nunnery is falling apart, there are hell demons walking the earth. And then you know, I think the line darkness devoured and destroyed everything, filling all space, filling the entire universe. And then we have the last line is utterly realist. It's Miss Fang with a long anguished moan fell to the ground. And it is this wonderful kind of snap back to where we actually were outside of her body and we kind of see her collapse because and we don't know. The assumption is that she is, you know, she may not be alive. Everything has been destroyed. And then in that last line, we're pulled back out, looking down at like you say, at the result, at the very realist kind of what has been wrought in a realist sense.
So let's talk about your work and your efforts bringing this to an English language audience, because it is, as I mentioned, really astounding. And I think it just won a prize. Isn't that right? The Penn Prize?
Yeah, it was when the before it was published, we got the Penn Prize.
Very congratulations.
Thank you.
Well deserved. So translation takes, as we know, a lot of time and a lot of energy, and it isn't always a kind of labor that's acknowledged in the way that other academic products are, right? And acknowledged, read any number of ways. Now, at the same time, translations often have much longer lives and are much more widely used and used by a much broader range of people than many of our other works. Mm-hmm. So how did you manage the work for this with your other teaching, research, and writing? For you, how did you make the labor involved in this work, given the larger ecology of the kinds of work that we need to do as academics?
That's an excellent question that I haven't completely answered, to be honest. My standard reaction is always that my academic research, my teaching, and my translation work in a cycle which I hope is virtuous. The idea being that no one reads closer than a translator.
That's right.
And for me, I almost need to do a translation to understand as closely as I need to do any academic analysis. And of course, to do a translation credit, you also have to do the background research, and you have to, you know, you have to figure out who Mao Dun was before you can translate him, and these sort of issues. So, the end result is that, you know, I whether or not I'm able to put out a monograph on Mao Dun, that's very much, you know, up for question. But I am pulling research from this translation that would have been impossible without the translation first happening. So mm-hmm. My hope is, and of course the teaching side of that is I'm always happy to give my students drafts of translations that I'm working on, not only to get, you know, more sets of eyes on it, but because it's a wonderful opportunity when you get truly fresh eyes on a piece of work. Sometimes we get so focused in our own little academic wells that it really does take an undergraduate who comes to you and says, "Well, this is clearly going on here, and you hadn't seen it before." So it's a hopefully, like I say, a virtuous cycle.
One of my favorite experiences of the last couple of years was, you know, trying to motivate myself to make progress on my current book manuscript by, with a few interns that I had, undergraduate interns, mm-hmm. offering them up a few pages at a time of the current chapter that I was working on for their feedback. And it was amazing because they would ask these questions that, you know, colleagues wouldn't ask right. because they're too close, but that were profoundly helpful. Like, you know, questions like, "I don't understand what the hell is going on here." You know, right. like, "What is up with this guy? Like, is this the same guy as that other guy? Like, what do you mean?" And it's these questions that I think are super, super useful, that we are often too close to the material, as are our colleagues, to ask. And I think they make it work much better.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because specifically with the character of Sun Wuyang, you know, we would have many weeks worth of discussion sections on what exactly was going on with that character. And because many of these students didn't have the kind of gender studies, the lit crit background, they were asking the most wonderful and incredibly pointed questions that really made me kind of shift my stance and see what the text was actually saying, rather than what I thought the text should be saying. And that's it's a wonderful opportunity.
So for you as a translator, let's talk a little bit, and we don't have a whole lot more time, but I want to talk a little bit about your experience translating this particular work. So you've mentioned some of the elements of Mao Dun's prose that are more or less challenging to get through as a translator. So maybe let's turn to that. Did any characteristics of his prose pose particular challenges in your work as a translator, and would you mind talking about them? If so,
I think I'm very fortunate in terms of Mao Dun being so focused on what he thought a realist novel should be, because his prose is incredibly clean. When there's not, you know, an actual mistake or a typo or something, but he writes in a fairly simple, fairly straightforward way that hopefully came out in English. But it also does, when he does decide to go for flights of fancy, when he does, you know, talk about crushed flowers and bits of dresses, or whenever he goes into rhapsodic descriptions of women's bodies, usually, it points those things out so clearly, and it's nice as a translator to be able to use those opportunities to push English a little bit, to be able to kind of give a little bit more rein to the way English can really be poetic in and you can even push it almost to being a slightly purple, because the realist background allows it to pop out so much more. And I think Mao Dun does that quite well in a way that other Chinese authors don't.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. So are there any, so immediately that makes me want to ask you if there are any moments like that where the prose allowed you to really push the English that stand out for you in your work on this?
Trying to think of a good example. There's one I have a page open right now that is not perhaps the example that I would choose if I had more time. But there's one of the passages that was deleted is talking about the way in which this is not from Waverings. This is from one of the other novels of the trilogy. But it's a description of one of our heroic characters who is supposed to become a kind of a model of socialist future in all of this. And she ends up losing her virginity to a man she shouldn't have lost her virginity to. And it's this wonderful description of her body exploding and her the pieces of herself kind of dissolving into mist. And I don't have the specific quote there, but it's fantastic in a way that's not illusion. It's not a hallucination, but it's that kind of post-orgasmic falling apart that is incredibly poetic and very much at odds with his standard kind of realist background speech. And of course, this is part that was deleted because it was showing in some way that she at least enjoyed losing her virginity. She enjoyed sex with this bad reactionary man. And so, of course, it wasn't allowed to stay in.
So thank you for that. Now this makes me want to go and read whatever it is you've got open on your desk right now. So what, as a translator, were your favorite or some of your favorite moments that you can recall at this point, right, in the conversation, of Wanderings that you translated? Were there any moments that you felt, wow, this was particularly satisfying as a translator to work through?
I think the illusions are obviously the most fun, and that's where I would come, particularly the final few pages. But I think as a translator, one of the most difficult things to work through was the violence. Mm-hmm. And I hesitate to say this is something that I enjoyed because obviously I didn't, but the one particular scene that's being described where a woman has had her breasts cut off, and I forget what the Chinese was, but I think my eventual rendering into English was that she was bleeding from below. Mm-hmm. And this is evocative of the very common, not just rapes that were going on during this period of this revolutionary violent period, but the desecration of particularly the female bodies, and it's a very, as a translator, I wanted to make sure that horror was brought out, and I wanted to be able for the reader to feel that horror. But there's a very fine line between trying to explain exactly what has happened and being overly literal in a way. You want the reader to see what happened and see what's written, but at the same time, you want it to be kind of like that laughter that comes over the temple wall. You want it to be hidden enough that the reader has to kind of ponder it and come to their own kind of horrified reaction, rather than have the text give you the horrified reaction, if that makes sense.
It does. In fact, we in a class I'm teaching, we just read Watchmen, the graphic novel,
sure,
right? And,
yeah,
and talked about,
oh God,
the importance of, just in terms of violence and the experience of violence in a narrative, the gutter, right, which is the space, mm-hmm, between different panels in a comic book. So you have that one moment of action and then another moment of action that are sequential, but there's something that happens from one to the other that's not depicted. And
right,
that's the responsibility of the reader to imagine that and to fill that in the passage from one to the other, right? And this is often described as a gutter. And what you just mentioned, the work that the reader needs to do to imagine and evoke what happened, that work, I think, at least for me in my experience of that passage that you're talking about where she's bleeding from below, it actually makes it a much more powerful experience as a reader. Right. Than if you had just said this happened, then this happened, then this happened. I mean, I think I found that to be incredibly powerful as a moment in the translation. And I think in part for that reason, because it is the reader is complicit in creating the narrative at that point and imagining what would have happened. Right. And that's it stays with you.
And that being complicit is something that Mao Dun is perhaps not consciously interested in, but I think that's something that happens with a lot of good writers, Mao Dun included, where with a little bit of pulling away from that explicitness, you can make the reader much more engaged and complicit, like you say. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
So, Dave, we've now, if I can't believe I'm saying this, but it's actually true, we've now come to the conclusion of the conversation. So there are probably a million billion things that we could talk about that we haven't had a chance to talk about. I mean, there's, in terms of your work as a translator, in terms of what's happening and the beauty of the prose of this novel and Mao Dun's work in context, and there's a lot that is here in the book for the reader, and I hope listeners do have a chance to pick up and not just read the book, but also teach with the book. I think that's something that that needs to be said, is that this is going to be an amazing resource for teaching as well as, you know, for reading and working through. Now, is there anything in particular or anything in general that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had the chance to become readers?
Well, I think you touch on something that's very close to my heart. This was designed to be a book for non-specialists. This was designed to be a book that anyone could pick up and read. And I think that especially for your listeners who are academics, as you said, translation is not usually given the standing that most academic work is given, and that's probably not something we can change in a day or two. But there's so much out there that is just begging to be translated, and very often we stay in our own lanes, and without giving more people an opportunity, non-Chinese speakers, an opportunity to read these things, I think we do, as academics, we do a great disservice to the field. If we can use translation to get more people reading these things, I think it does us good, because in classes we can have these conversations. But I think it, in broader terms, it is kind of a grand social good, if I can be a little hyperbolic. But I think we should take translation more seriously than we do.
I completely agree with you. And as just a kind of brief follow-up question for listeners who might be with us today, who are thinking, yeah, that's great, I want to, you know, do some translation from Chinese into English. What would be a great, what basically for you, Dave, as a translator, but also as a reader, are there any works in Chinese that you think are screaming to be translated into English love to see? If you had a million billion dollars to just give to someone and extra years of their life to just be here, what would you love to see translated into English?
Well, I think today we're luckily seeing kind of a rebirth of translation of contemporary things. We're with Ken Liu and some other people, we're getting some wonderful science fiction stuff that's being translated recently, and I'm very excited to see that. But because it's where my heart is, I don't think we need to go in. I don't have a specific authors in mind, but I think there's so much in the butterfly fiction era and in kind of the roaring 20s wild era A lot of people, I think, have a bias toward grand fiction, a bias toward canonical works, and that's critical, and we have to do that, obviously. But I think it's a shame to ignore popular things, ignore things that were very that people loved to read, because I think that tells us so much about, you know, not just the intellectuals, not just the scholarly folks, but what did people enjoy? And I think that's really critical to understand, particularly in the pre-revolutionary period, where I think we think that everyone was walking around reading Lu Xun and Shen Tongwen and Ding Ling, and of course they weren't. But we need those people. But I think we need the popular stuff as well.
So now that the book is out, and congratulations again, it's already received acclaim, and it really is a marvelous translation. What's next for you? What are you currently working on?
Well, I do have some articles that I'm working on, but the next big thing that I'm working on, I'm halfway through a new translation by Zhang Tianyi of a novel that I'm calling The Pigeon Warrior. Tentatively, that's the title.
Ooh.
And it's a satire, 1930s satire of kung fu novels and nationalism in kind of this half colonialized Shanghai. And it's the gist of the story is it's a guy who has done nothing but read kung fu novels his whole life, and he wants to go. He's chased off into Shanghai, and he wants to find a master who can teach him kung fu to kick out all the invading foreigners. And it's a long series of people duping him with cons and tricking him out of his money. It's a crazy romp.
Well, that sounds awesome. So finish that up, and then we'll talk about that next. So give me an email when that comes out, and we will definitely, definitely be talking about The Pigeon Warrior. Okay, thank you so much, Dave. It really was a pleasure. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you so much, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.